and welcome to a spooky episode of Lost in Science. This is our annual Halloween episode where we get lost in science fiction. Who are we? I'm Stu, and with me this week I have Chris.
Hello.
Hey, Chris. What weird science fiction story have you got for us this week?
Oh, look, I was going to come in inspired by the fact there is a Superman movie release. I was going to come in with the whole thing about how Superman gets his power from the sun. But I realized that's just a bunch of calculations about the solar energy per square meter. And it's probably only interesting to myself and a very small number of other people. Spoiler alert, it's not very practical that a human can power themselves by solar energy. Well, Kryptonian, but, you know, a human-shaped person. Even though solar power is, you know, very useful.
Mm. Yeah.
Anyway, that was going nowhere, but fortunately, we have a quantum science and technology year story that Nature, the journal Nature, has done some interviews with physicists to find their favourite movies. And so I'm going to talk about the movies that physicists seem to like, apart from Superman, apparently, which, again, just me would seem.
As long as it's not all just Oppenheimer, is it? Because that'll be really slow, dull story,
it's
short story.
It's not actually Oppenheimer, but good. you're not far off, Stu.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, we'll listen anyway. and also, Lyndon's here. Hey, Lyndon, what have you got for us?
G'day, Stu. Well, this is my first science Lost in Science fiction episode, and I wanted to do something weather related. What's the best weather related science fiction movie? Best, you know, that's a relative term, of course. The 2013 instant classic Sharknado. I want to get into it to understand how likely Sharknado might actually be. Not just in terms of the weather phenomenon, but how would you get so many sharks in such a concentrated area of the ocean that they could then all get sucked up? How would they go about being up in the air? And then how would they behave if they did somehow manage to make it onto land? It's gripping. It's got all the sciences that you need. It's got meteorology, it's got physics, it's got biology, and it's, you know, unlike the movie, I got a few facts.
Great. I've seen it and I have some questions for you, clearly.
It sounds like it's going to be a whirlwind. Claire, hello.
Well, Lyndon, that is very, very fitting that you're doing Sharknado, because it's 50 years since that other shark film.
Keep going. We might get it soon.
It's Jaws. It's 50 years since Jaws. Obviously, you know, I mean, the movie that most famously paved the way for Sharknado. And so we're going to talk about where it all began with the shark movie as well. I love Jaws, but it has some very dodgy biological science in it.
I mean, you know, Richard Dreyfuss is a biological scientist, so he should have got it all right, surely.
Yeah. But there's a lot of things that we didn't know about sharks then.
Oh, that we know now?
Yeah. Well, that we know now. Yeah.
Okay. I am going to be talking about an obscure movie from 1990 because, of course, I am. I'm going to be talking about a movie called Hardware, which you may have seen or potentially not have seen, which is about a killer robot in the future.
I believe I've seen it, yeah.
I believe you may. It sounds like the sort of thing you might have seen. Chris.
Probably at a 24-hour science fiction marathon at the Valhalla. But, you know.
That's exactly where I saw it, too. Yeah. So,
I thought I recognised you, yeah.
But yeah, so I'm going to be talking about that and kind of, you know, what are the realistic applications of robots in the military, because there actually are some and they're probably in some ways as scary as the film. So we'll be talking about that later on in the show, so please stay tuned.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
All right, yes, you are listening to Lost in Science. My name is Chris, and I am legally obligated in the year of quantum science and technology to talk about any related story that comes out. It would appear. And this is apparently, look, it's not purely quantum related, but as I said in the intro, the journal Nature, or the magazine Nature, however you want to describe it, has decided to interview some scientists, mostly physicists, about their favourite movies to see if there was any kind of view of what they gravitate towards, no pun intended. And look, I think you mentioned a film in the intro there, did you, Stu?
I did mention Oppenheimer, yes. It was a huge film.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be surprised if no physicists liked it.
Look, there's some did, but I said you're on the right track. There were two Christopher Nolan films that scored very highly.
Oh, me. Is it, yes, Interstellar?
Interstellar was one of them, oh, absolutely. Yeah. Interstellar that, look, it had some interesting, I don't know if everyone's seen it, it's got some interesting stuff, particularly around black holes, the way that black holes distort times, particularly memorable scenes. The depiction of black hole was well portrayed in that movie, done some actual modelling to show what black holes would really look like. That has now become the default way of picturing black holes. Like, it goes off the rails towards the end there with some weird stuff with Matthew McConaughey's character going inside a black hole. No spoilers there, exactly what happens, but yeah, it's not entirely clear how that saves the world, but it does.
Possibly also popular with surfers, because there's some pretty gnarly waves, dude.
There is. I was just confused by what his character's name was. It has been kind of revealed, and he didn't realize what his character's name was. Like, everyone calls him Coop, and so Cooper is clearly his last name, but then his granddaughter or his daughter gets named after him as Cooper, her first name, so that make her Cooper. I didn't understand that at all. That was really bothering me. So anyway, look, that was one Christopher Nolan. The other one, I won't let you guess it, was The Prestige, which is the...
Oh, with Tesla.
Yeah, I think the Tesla stuff, the fact that it kind of uses some sciencey things there, and it's all about, you know, that kind of, yeah, the wonder of science. I don't know. It seemed like a bit of a stretch for a sciencey thing, but that was like the other really popular Nolan film. Do you want to guess what any other popular films might be?
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, no, but you're not far wrong. A couple of time travel films made the list.
Back to the Future.
Yes, of course. Back to the Future. And another one, I mean, when you think time travel films, you know, landmark time travel films, you can't go past the 80s and Star Trek IV, A Voyage Home, where the crew travel back to the 1980s to save some whales. Wow. Yeah.
Wow. That's great. It is true to stereotype.
It's a good movie. It's a good movie. I remember that. I mean, it's not my favorite time travel movie, but it holds up, I think.
Were the scientists asked, what's your favorite movie or what's your favorite science fiction movie?
I think this is all science fiction. I mean, it's pretty... basically the same thing.
I think, did they just love all saying nuclear vessels?
Possibly. Well, the last one, I suppose, is a science fiction film, and I won't make you guess it. It's a superhero film. It was the animated film Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which is a good movie, but from what I can see, basically got points because it features prominently a particle accelerator as a plot point. So I feel like a lot of this is purely about, you know, physicists just looking for things that they relate to. It's like, oh, particle accelerator. Oh, you know, gravitational distortion. Oh,
flux capacitor.
Flux capacitor.
It's all about representation.
I can't believe Ant-Man didn't get a look in. Isn't that a really accurate reflection?
That's a slap in the face to quantum physics.
Oh gosh, don't even get me started. I don't actually know where to start. I mentioned I was going to talk about some superhero physics things. I started to look into that. They mostly make no sense, all the superhero physics, so you cannot go very far with those discussions. But yeah, look, I think they picked some good films there. You know, maybe our Lost in Science listeners could tell us what their favourites are. If Hardware is up there on yours, well, you know, and Sharknado are your top films, I think you come to the right place.
Welcome back to Lost in Science Fiction, where, I mean, it feels like a bit of a party pooper to undo all the excellent science that we see in science fiction films. So Let's have a look at a film that maybe got famous for just how bad it is. And there are plenty of films out there that do that. But Sharknado is a movie that is likely to annoy scientists from a range of genres, right? And I think it's mainly because of just how completely implausible it is, obviously. We're in Los Angeles. There is a hurricane that sweeps through, that floods the city. The city is full of sharks, therefore, because the floodwaters have brought in this massive, massive, like, pod of sharks.
I mean, I thought they were pretty solitary creatures. So the fact that there's so many sharks...
Yes, exactly.
What's going on?
Yeah, so that's point one, right? That's cross one out of this very intellectually stimulating film. And the second part, of course, we have these floodwaters that are brought in by a huge hurricane off the coast of Los Angeles, and then three massive tornadoes start forming and they suck up all the sharks, and then the sharks start falling out of the sky. Ah! And not only that, but when the sharks start falling... they're annoyed. And so they just start chomping. They just start chomping down on everybody that they see.
Angry sharks. Angry I mean, sharks. One of the other questions is, there's only sharks.
Yeah.
There's no other sea creatures in there. So it's got nothing to do with their mass or their shape. I mean, there's no dolphins in there. There's no octopi.
Maybe they ate all the other creatures in the tornado.
In the NATO, yeah.
Okay, well, then let's address a little bit of truth in this. There are storms that have picked up heavier things than a shark, right? Your big F4 or F5 tornadoes can lift up a cow, which is heavier than your average shark. You know, it can lift up tractors, knock over buildings, do all sorts of things like that.
But a cow in the ocean?
The cow, not the cow of the sea. No, the cow. I haven't read of a manatee being picked up before.
Manatee NATO.
That's the kids' version of the movie.
That's the kids' version, yeah.
Well, the other thing to note is that water spouts, right, so tornadoes that kind of form over water are generally not as strong as tornadoes that form over land, because the kind of differences in temperature that you get and the kind of level of instability in the atmosphere doesn't become quite as much. So you can park that. But a little bit of truth is that you can get tornadoes or waterspouts or storms that can pick up creatures, aquatic creatures, and move them quite a long distance. So there's a town in Western Australia, 300 kilometres away from the ocean, but it's got creek beds nearby. It's called Lajamanu, and they have got like a long history of fish being dropped in their town due to storms. Little ones, like maybe 5-10 centimetres long, that will fall out of the sky. It's happened 3 or 4 times over the last 40 to 50 years. The fish are alive when they fall, so they've obviously been sucked up from... they're tiny little perch. I don't know if the research has really been done on the fury scale of perch. Maybe that could be a topic for next year's show. But they do make it up into the atmosphere. They're low enough that they don't get frozen, and then they fall down and they're alive. They get collected by kids, and it's, quite an amazing feat. But I don't know if they're angry or not. So the first point. So this... the movie Sharknado is saying that there was a massive clump of great white sharks just off the coast, 20,000 sharks hanging out there that were ready and available to be flooded into Los Angeles. Would you get 20,000 sharks altogether? Probably not. Like you say, Claire, they are solitary animals. Not only that, but they're quite good at identifying pressure differences. So if a big hurricane was coming through, which is what happens in the plot of Sharknado, they'd probably dive deeper down because they knew that there'd be some turbulent weather coming. So you can probably cross that one off the list of, okay, great, maybe there's not going to be that many sharks, but possibly there could be some sharks, right? So if you do get a big hurricane and then you've got this, you know, set up where, so a hurricane and a tropical cyclone and a typhoon are sort of all the same thing, and they can have tornadoes inside them or like as a part of the storm walls, which are kind of the edges of the cyclone. So tornadoes are much, much smaller than cyclones. And they can have the strength to pull up these big, big creatures. But could they hold them up for long enough? this article that I read does a lot of calculations about the terminal velocity of a shark.
Is it different when it's gnashing its teeth?
Yeah, exactly. Which direction is the shark in, and, you know, the scale of the shark? Yeah, it would have to be a really, really, you'd need to get about a wind speed of about 322 kilometers an hour, which is about twice the strength of a waterspout. So you would need to have, yeah, a 3 or 4 on the Fujitsu tornado damage scale. So it can overturn a train or throw a car or something like that. So it would be possible, but the atmosphere would have to try really hard. And then finally, if these sharks, some of the sharks, right, just enough to get a few sprinklings of sharks in your tornado, were able to be lifted up because the tornado was incredibly strong, if they fell out of the sky then, how would they behave? Would they start biting people? Would they, you know, be so angry that they'd eat someone straight out of the sky? Or so the sharks maybe could, if we can get over step one and step two. Step three, you'd need the sharks to have enough water. They can't breathe when they're out of water. Those little fish were able to survive in Western Australia, but sharks are much, much bigger. And then if they did fall out of the sky, they probably wouldn't be furious. They'd probably be really afraid and confused and unlikely to swallow a heroin whole, only to be saved a bit later by someone with a chainsaw jumping through the sky and hacking out that person completely safe, just unconscious in the shark's tummy. So,
Steve from Beverly Hills 90210, I will point out there, yes.
Thanks, Chris. Yes.
I think my favourite part, which sums up the scientific rigour which the writers went to write that film, is when Tara Reid walks into someone's office, pulls out a 19th century brass microscope out of her bag, which she just happened to be carrying around, puts it down on the desk and says, "Let's get to work," and just starts looking down the microscope. At what? We don't know. It's a mystery for the ages, Tara. But it's amazing stuff.
Claire, you've got more sharks to tell us about. The OG shark.
Yes. So, I mean, we've talked a lot about sharks already, but you know what I say when it comes to sharks? A sharknado is not enough sharks. We need more sharks. And I think we should celebrate. It's been 50 years since the original shark movie came out, Jaws. And still to this day, when people go into the water, they think about it. It's had an ongoing worldwide psychological impact and also devastating effects on shark populations. But just even, and also hearing that sound, da-dum, da-dum, you can be swimming on the brightest day in the most lovely water and then someone does that, bam, I'm out of the water. It gives me instant terrors. Have you guys seen it? Have you guys seen this classic?
Of course.
I saw it on IMAX for the 50th anniversary, so yes.
Great. Lyndon?
I haven't seen it, but I have very hazy memories of going on the Jaws ride at Universal Studios in America when I was a little kid.
You've pretty much seen it.
Yeah, I've pretty much seen it. There's a bridge and there's a shark, and then the shark retracts back into the water.
and you survived.
I did.
Yep. You and, what's his name? Richard Dreyfuss. So, it is a hunt for a gigantic, bloodthirsty rogue shark that has attacked all these people at, I think it's Martha's Vineyard in the US, one summer. And it is terrifying. Obviously, also, like, the breakthrough movie from Steven Spielberg. And the other famous thing about the film is, as you say, Lyndon, the star of the film, the real star of the film, the giant animatronic shark head that's full of sharp shark teeth and lurches out of the water and terrified you as a child into sort of having those memorable core experiences of Universal Studios. It's terrifying. So in the movie, actually, so there's this animatronic shark, but then there's also real shark footage. And the real shark footage is great white sharks. It was actually shot by an Australian couple in South Australia. Mm. So there's some they're Aussie sharks in the film. But back to the animatronic one, or as he was known on set, Bruce.
Yes.
Yes.
Bruce is the name of the shark in Finding Nemo. Mm.
That's right. It's all connected, Lindo. It's all connected.
Are they set in the same universe?
So Bruce was actually named after Spielberg's lawyer. Just a cruel joke that has...
Not because of Ron and Valerie Taylor, who are the shark filming experts, which would fit as well because it's a very Aussie-sounding name.
It is, Bruce, totally. And, Bruce had very realistic jaws, which is good given the name. It had lots of rows of sharp teeth, which was pretty good considering at the time we didn't have a lot of exposure as to what great whites, you know, what they actually did or how they functioned or really, really much about them. But one of the things that doesn't stack up about great white sharks was the size, obviously, Bruce. Jaws is close to 8 meters and the weight of a minibus. So, I mean, just think about how much of a Sharknado would, how much power you'd need yeah. to draw him up into a water spout.
That's an F10 or something.
That is. So 8 meters, I mean, the biggest great white that we have seen, they reach a maximum of about 6 meters. So there's a bit of a difference there, but it's only 2 meter difference. And in my head, I'm like, I mean, a 6 meter shark is still on a beach, is still equally as terrifying. So I'm like, yes, but also still pretty scary. Now, one of the other biological inconsistency is the sex of the shark. So in great white sharks, it's actually the females that are the bigger sharks, not the males. And Bruce, apart from the male-sounding name, if you look carefully at the footage in the movie that came from the live sharks in South Australia, you can see that the shark has male sex organs called claspers on his belly. So he is a male, but it doesn't check out that he's so giant. If he was that giant, he'd probably be a female. Mm. So there you go.
So
Brucette.
Brenda. So Brenda. The Meg, that other excellent film, let's get into some more high-quality shark action. Is that a female shark?
That's a prehistoric shark that they woke up somehow magically.
But is it a female prehistoric Megalodon?
But it's called Meg.
It's obviously, Meg. Yeah. Clearly a female.
Well, they got that right at least.
Now, some other inconsistencies to quickly mention. Look, we've got it on good authority with solid scientific evidence that sharks are not vindictive. They don't target people and they don't eat people whole, as the movie suggests. Their teeth are actually quite well evolved for impact and then tearing shreds. I mean, I don't know if that's supposed to make us feel better, but there you have it. There's a lot to delve into when it comes to Jaws. And also, one of the other great moments in the movie is when Jaws sort of roars a bit, like makes an audible sound, which is just an absolute fiction. Sharks don't roar, even though I know. I can see why it would be tempting to make them roar, because roaring is scary. But anyway, look, there's really too much to fit into, too much of these excellent shark stories to fit right here. So, I mean, we're gonna need a bigger show.
Yes, you are listening to Lost in Science Fiction, and I don't know if this is a wise idea now, but I'm going to do a deep dive. I recently got my hands on a 4K ultra-high definition copy of a 1990 cult science fiction film called Hardware.
So not on Laserdisc?
No. Well, there's some issues with getting it on anything for a while, because the people who put money into it made a lot more money than they thought, and then someone changed their mind and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it didn't come out on DVD until 2009, so it took a while to get out there. But anyway, I did have it on VHS. I did see it at the cinema, as I said earlier. It's a cult film for a number of reasons. It has a heavy metal, punk, industrial soundtrack. It's got Motorhead, Public Image Limited, and Ministry on the soundtrack. It's got cameos by Iggy Pop and Lemmy from Motorhead in the film. Now, the director, Richard Stanley, does mostly horror films, and this was his first feature film. He actually got sued successfully by the publishers of 2000 AD Comics, because he kind of ripped off one of their comics to make the story. But he also made a weird H.P. Lovecraft adaptation much more recently called Color Out of Space with Nicolas Cage a few years ago, which was very weird. It's Nicolas Cage, so you get what you get, right? Let's just say he likes to make weird films. Hardware is about an artist whose boyfriend gives her a metallic skull as a present in a dystopian, post-apocalyptic, future wasteland world. You know, fairly similar to what we live in, but a little bit worse. The artifact turns out to be part of a military robot killing machine called Mark 13, which is named after a passage in the Bible which states, "No flesh shall be spared." So that's a little uplifting point for the movie. It's also programmed to be able to repair itself. So she gets given this skull. The fun starts as the artist in the film works in metal. So it has a whole pile of parts to play with and put itself back together while she goes out for a while to do post-apocalyptic stuff. I don't know why she leaves the flat, but anyway. And one of the things I think the film is right about is that the military are very interested in autonomous killing machines. It's not a new theme. The look of the bot in this film is reminiscent of Terminator from 6 years earlier. I mean, obviously, if you're going to make a skeleton out of metal, it's going to look pretty similar regardless of who's making the movie. This one does have more limbs. It's got actually 6 limbs, which is, you know, it's a little bit of a riff on the humanoid robot. And, you know, the military is really interested in this. A quote from Major Kenneth Rose of the US Army's Training and Doctrine Command: "Machines don't get tired, they don't close their eyes, they don't hide under trees when it rains, they don't talk to their friends. A human's attention to detail on guard duty drops dramatically in the first 30 minutes. Machines know no fear." This is what the Army is looking for, apparently. Or, to quote Kyle Reese from Terminator, "It can't be bargained with, it can't be reasoned with, it doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear, and it absolutely will not stop ever until you are dead."
Or until an unscheduled update comes through and it just freezes.
They clearly are not running them on Windows, hopefully. Just please do not restart. Your computer is updating. The thing that I find is very unlikely is that we'll see much use of human-shaped autonomous fighting machines. Partly because if we want human-shaped things to do things humans can do, it's cheaper to use humans. You train the humans to go and do the stuff. That makes much more sense. You can armor them, you can arm them, you can do whatever you want. But why build a robot to do stuff that humans can do when humans can already do that stuff? It doesn't really make a lot of sense. The main reason to use autonomous military robots is to do things humans can't do or don't want to do, which raises some ethical questions. But let's be honest, there's not much about warfare that doesn't raise ethical questions. So the most commonly used autonomous robots are currently surveillance drones. So this is probably the first thing people knew of as drones, and they've been calling them drones since the 90s. And you're talking about, they're not human-shaped, but they're plane-shaped, and they're very commonly used. And quadcopter drones are probably also the second most commonly used autonomous vehicles or autonomous automated combat machines. Being used in actual conflicts, the Ukraine-Russian war, they're being used all the time in that. Now, for things on the ground, it's a bit different. We're not looking at, you know, Terminator robots or walking around android-shaped robots. We're looking at things like, there's a number of basically bulldozer-shaped or tank-shaped autonomous or remote-controlled vehicles which are used for demolition or delivery of explosives to specific targets, and basically, you know, remote controlled or autonomous tanks. It's not really that hard to understand.
It's like Daleks, basically.
Pretty much like Daleks. But these things have actually been used since the late stages of the Second World War. The German military had little miniature tanks that could roll over to where the enemy was and then explode. So they were using them for a long time. They were remote controlled. So this is not new technology even. It's pretty pretty well established. Not that they really took off. So look, there are more specific robots that can shoot and do other tasks, but they're mostly either on wheels or on tracks. There's not really any walking aroundy robot military agents, but there are bipedal and quadrupedal robots in development for use in combat roles, and there are numerous companies doing this, and you've probably seen things like the Boston Dynamics dogs and that sort of stuff. Basically what they're talking about is, you know, strapping guns onto them and sending them off as autonomous fighting machines. We don't actually know how effective that will be. No one's really deployed them in that kind of role. That remains to be seen, how that's actually going to turn out. So I guess if we want to find out if these, you know, android or animal shaped robots are going to be any good, we'll have to pay attention when they roll out or walk out in a theater near you.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.